years. In fact, I now know that there's somebody who's been in this game longer than me in this room, and that's Professor Michael Levy, who I've known for, I'm sure, around that time. So I come at this, and I come to you today, with an individualistic perspective, I suppose. I'm a barrister, I'm a hired tongue. I'm giving you a courtroom perspective. You'll get a perspective from somebody who mostly represents the good guys, the victims, as I do. Sometimes represents the bad guys, the crooks, the defendants. And sometimes actually represent lawyers themselves. I have a sort of super specialism in looking after lawyers who get themselves, or try to stop them getting themselves into trouble, but then help them if they do get into trouble themselves. And I come at it from both a practitioner's viewpoint, but I suppose something of an academic as well. I've written some texts on the proceeds of crime. Now, I want to sort of respond and pick up the encouragement that I'm given to try to make suggestions as to what we could do better. And I'm going to give some critical comments, I think, about what we've been doing in the UK. And I mean that in the best possible sense, because I think all of this stuff really matters. And when I made the point earlier on about, you know, do we really need a 250,000 reports and so on, the point was, would we be better off having 50,000 reports or something like that? I wasn't advocating, of course, that we don't have any at all. And so my comments, I hope, will be received in the right way, because I do believe in this system. I believed in it since the day I first sort of clapped eyes on confiscation, which was about 20 years ago, when I was representing a chemist who had been selling drugs illegally out of the back door, which were highly poisonous. I remember it was diazepam or something like this. But it was highly poisonous in the hands of people who inject it. And in fact, we're injecting it in Scotland, so the evidence showed, very, very commonly in the Glasgow area and so on, because the drug itself solidifies in the veins, apparently, when it is boiled down from being a tablet and then injected into the vein, gives somebody a high, but also gives them a very, very high risk of stroke. And so I thought, well, this is interesting. I'm dealing with this chemist. He doesn't seem to care about the victims and what he's done. He didn't even seem to care very much that he was banged up for 2 years in prison. But he really cared, it seemed to me, about the fact that he was going to lose his house. And it was the house that he lived in with his parents, and that they would be dehomed as well. So the potency of all of this was really brought home to me. So please, I hope that the powers that be will forgive me then for saying that some critical things now, as I will now do, because actually I do believe in this system. I just wish and hope that it would become even more effective than I think it has been. Now, confiscation goes back 20-odd years at least, and in our earlier regimes, prior to the Proceeds of Crime Act, we developed a case law which lived on into the Proceeds of Crime Act regime. There was a turning point in about 2000, well, I said turning point, a point in 2003 when the House of Lords, as it then was, grappled with the existential question of why we have confiscation in a case called Resvi and Bengerfield. And it was looking back at the old regime, but then with an eye to the future as well, and declared that we have it for three reasons. One, to punish convicted offenders. Two, to deter the commission of further offences. And three, to reduce profits available to fund further enterprises. So it placed an element of punitivity out there, and sort of said that that's one of the legitimate purposes of confiscation. And that, to my mind, was the whole feature of the first 20 years or 18 years of confiscation law that we had. And I'm not going to canter through it. But what we saw in those first 18 years or so of confiscation law being developed were, I think, a number of themes. Firstly, defendants were being hammered by confiscation in this sense. They were being hammered because the courts were being invited by aggressive prosecutors to declare that individual defendants had made enormous sums of money from crimes when in fact they hadn't. And I'll give you an illustration. There was a case involving six money launderers who were just young guys who were passing a suitcase of cash onto each other. And it happened in London that they were, at one stage, it was passed through Victoria Railway Station. And these individuals were eventually prosecuted for various offences, and it was drugs money, I think, seem to recall. And each of them were made subject to confiscation orders in the full amount of the cash that was passed from one to another. I can't remember the exact sums, but I know that it was £500,000 in the suitcase because I represented one of the defendants, and I can remember that fact. Now, the total confiscation orders then was a multiple of the amount of money in question. And of course there were objections from defence lawyers and so on at the time, but they were overridden by the aggressive prosecution development of this jurisprudence, and the court went along with it and bought it, leading to this sort of multiplier effect of the in terms of the amount that was said to be subject then to confiscation. Of course, the reality was that nobody was ever going to find £3 million worth of cash. It didn't exist. You only ever had £500,000 worth of cash, albeit that you could say that there were other assets that you could go after, and they may well have been. The position was compounded for defendants in that the courts readily developed, again, the invitation of prosecutors, readily developed a jurisprudential line of thinking which along these lines, which is that if a defendant doesn't articulate themselves good reasons why they don't have money in their hands, the courts will readily assume that they have hidden assets which the prosecutors can then ask to be put into the calculating pot to then make a confiscation order. And I think we saw, over 18 years, we have seen large numbers of confiscation orders made which bear almost no reality, or very little reality at times, to the amount of money that really is available to confiscate. Or at least there's a serious disconnect between the two. And what I think I've also seen myself, and I don't think I'm the only person to say this, is that although we have seen a huge number of sort of magnificent confiscation orders made, in terms of collection of those confiscation orders, a great deal less effort put into the enforcement side of things. And that may be for two reasons. One, it's much harder to go and actually enforce these orders than it is to get them in the first place. And secondly, if you're a prosecuting, a sort of enforcement division faced with these sort of huge orders based on unreal amounts of assets and so on, you don't know where to begin apart from anything else. So I think that I'm exaggerating things perhaps, or at least I'm saying things in quite sort of strident and trenchant terms, but there has been, I believe, this disconnect between the reality of the situation. Now, that went on for year after year after year. And I have no real sympathy for defendants as such, but what I do think it did was actually have some really damaging effects on our criminal justice system. Firstly, the threat of a disproportionate benefit calculation, I believe, inhibited defendants from pleading guilty or settling prosecution sort of confiscation cases where they could have been guilty pleas and there could have been settlement. So defendants, when told by their defence lawyers, if you go down for this, you're going to lose everything, and they're not only going to come after you for what you've got, they're going to come after you for what you don't have as well. Those defendants thought, well, I'm not going to plead guilty in those circumstances. There's no way I'm doing a deal. I mean, they're going to not just take the shirt off my back, they're going to try and take the shirt off me that I don't even own, and so on and so on and so on. And so it built up that inhibition against pleading guilty. It also allowed for a good deal of criticism for the government departments then took for their failures to actually collect on confiscation orders. A few years ago, I was invited by the BBC Panorama programme to appear on their programme to talk about the failings of government in confiscation. And I refused to take part in it. I met with the producers in a cafe, had a chat with them about it, and it could seem to me that what they really wanted to do was present this fairly biased impression of how everyone was incompetent and it was all one big failure and so on and so on. And that they had a politician, I think it was David Blunkett, who did then appear on the programme. There was a QC who did appear on the programme and so on, who were willing to supply the sort of lines that they wanted. But I wasn't, and I told them so. And I said to them, no, you've got the wrong target here. The target is the law itself. If you are seeing the figures look so bad, it's because the law is bad. And that's what needs to be straightened out. It's not because of lack of effort on the part of genuine good prosecutors who are doing their best. It's just that we have all these disconnects and these weirdnesses in our sort of situation. And I spoke about this sort of subject at many international conferences. And when doing so, many sort of foreign lawyers would scratch their heads and think, you know, wow, this is just amazing. You have this sort of unreal thing going on in your country. You know, you pretend to confiscate loads of money, when in reality it's just not there. And I think that set us back, and I think it really set prosecutors back, because it made them look like failures, as the Panorama programme wanted to portray them, which I just think wasn't true or right. So what's changed and what is changing? Well, the change began, I think, legally, in cases in about 2008 and 2009, because our Court of Appeal, the English and Welsh Court of Appeal, began to see this disconnect and start to do something about it. And they did so by using the concept of abusive process and saying, well, if there's this disproportionate amount trying to be confiscated versus the actual crime in question and so on, we will start to say it is an abusive process to have that. But it was a rather unsatisfactory line of reasoning, because it's quite difficult to call an act of Parliament itself an abusive process. So there was a good deal of sort of discussion about whether the court should be developing that line of jurisprudence. But it was the start of pushback. And so in a case called Frost in 2009, the Court of Appeal also said that they were going to not make a confiscation order against someone who hadn't actually got property in their hands. Because one of the things that had been, one of these sort of envelopes had been pushed over the previous sort of 10 years, 15 years, was an idea that even where a defendant didn't actually receive any money themselves, if they're part of the whole enterprise, well, then they can get slapped with a confiscation order as well. And the Court of Appeal started to say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to look at what somebody actually got. And they said, we're not going to be... And if it's the employer who actually got the money instead, or a company that got the money instead, well, then we are not going to necessarily always punish the individual or slap the confiscation on the individual. And by 2009, in the Court of Appeal, in the case called Allpress, went on to effectively overrule a couple of decades' worth of jurisprudence when it said that the cash courier, the guy who just hands the bag over, is no longer going to be liable. So those individuals who were sort of 15 years earlier found liable for handing over bags were no longer going to be found liable in confiscation terms. Of course, they're still going to be liable criminally for being money launderers. That's a different thing. But things really changed for the better, in my view, in 2012 in the game-changing case of Weyer. Now, this R versus Weyer in the Supreme Court, which I think held its hearings in the late part of 2011. I won't give you the ins and outs of the case, but the one really interesting feature of it was, and I think it was in September 2011 that it was heard, and it was one of the first hearings to be heard that were televised in the Supreme Court. Because I got a phone call from a friend of mine who's bigger in this area than I am, and said, Ian, switch on your television now. Get on and watch it. You know, it's on some channel or somewhere, or probably on the internet or something like that. I didn't actually. But he said, switch it on now, because so-and-so is making his, making his speech in this case, and so on. And he said, the judges, he said, you wouldn't believe it, Ian. They're telling the defence lawyers how to run their case. You just wouldn't credit it. You wouldn't believe it. And that's exactly what happened in this case. The Supreme Court stopped the proceedings. They were so concerned that about what had been going on, if you like, for the last sort of 15, 18 years. They said that they stopped the proceedings and wanted to adjourn it, and did adjourn the case for months, so that they could look at the law themselves, and so that they could then later receive proper submissions from defendants, or 5 minutes left, proper submissions from defendants as to what should happen in these sorts of confiscation cases. And this was a case where there was this threatened risk of complete disconnect between what somebody actually made in the crime as against what the prosecutors were seeking to get from this person. And the way the Supreme Court resolved things was to, for the first time, look at the law through the prism of Article 1 of Protocol 1 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which thankfully, in my view, we still have at the moment, or they may lose. And what they said was, if one looks through this prism, you look properly at what is proportionate when it comes to removing somebody's private property, which is what this is all about. Stripping away the proceeds of crime. That is a piece of private property that someone has a right to peaceful enjoyment over, unless there's a proportionate need for society to claw it away from them. And that, of course, can be proportionate in the case of confiscation of the proceeds of crime. But, they said, you must have some relationship of proportionality, because if you don't, you won't have a fair result. And so that was a seminal game changer. I mean, we should have all looked back to, I think it was Socrates who said, all laws must be proportionate. It's not a new invention of idea. It's an old idea, but it's been given new life by the Supreme Court. And that's been followed up. I won't give you the details, but there's been another seminal case called R versus Ahmad and Fields in 2014 before the Supreme Court. Now, what always has concerned me is not just this disproportionality, but as a victim's lawyer, what has always concerned me greatly as well, alongside the rise of these disproportionate confiscations, is the, in my view, either static nature of compensation to victims, or worse, the going down of compensation orders. Now, we heard just now that from the Home Office, they've accepted that confiscation orders have dipped in the last year or so. Compensation orders to victims. And to me, that signals a really, really immense disappointment. The idea that we confiscate something like, I think it was £190 million of receipts, but only compensate victims to the tune of £22 million, seems to me all wrong. Now, I know that there must be reasons why sometimes you should confiscate but not compensate, drug cases and so on, where there's no victims. But in many, many cases, there are victims. And it seems to me the stampede of laws to the Supreme Court up there and back down and so on has largely ignored the plight of victims. There has been no stampede of laws to the Court of Appeal, let alone the Supreme Court, on behalf of victims. Why? Because victims have no voice in criminal proceedings. They have no right of standing, save in respect of restitution orders, which is a subject in itself, which are almost unheard of. But in the case of compensation, victims are given no voice at all. They have no right to say anything to a judge. And if a compensation order is not made, they have no right to challenge that lack of compensation order either by judicial review or anything like that. And I think that's shameful myself. I think that the state employs all its resources or most of its resources in trying to recover proceeds of crime for itself, but does not do enough for victims. Now, I'll give you a quote, and this is a quote from a police officer, apparently, which is quoted in a study by Professor Button at the University of Portsmouth in his paper, Fraud and Punishment, Enhancing Deterrence Through More Effective Sanctions. He quotes a police officer whose views, I think, are hair-raising, and I hope not representative, but suspect they may be more widespread than we want. The police officer apparently said this: I had a conversation with a sergeant in a neighbouring force who said, we only do the ones where we have don't have an identified victim, because we get to keep the money. If you've got a victim and the victim is going to get the money, we're not interested. I don't think that could be said to be too widespread. But even just one incident of that, or a handful of incidences like that, is dangerous. And I think that what the officer was talking about there was the fact that the incentive schemes which are in place to give money back, which are receipts from confiscation, back to police forces, prosecutors and so on, could have that dangerous effect of skewing their priorities, when in my mind the priorities first and foremost must be to the victims of identifiable victim crimes. Now, we have been asked to come up with ideas for law changes. I could come up with a whole raft of changes, but I didn't think it's the right thing to do, to give you from the podium. We're also, 1 minute left, also asked to talk about international cooperation. I've been lucky enough to be sponsored to attend some conferences in Europe in the last year on international mutual legal assistance, sponsored by the European Union to go and, if you like, be an expert at these conferences. And I've had the fortune to speak to some people who work in the mutual legal assistance units in other countries in Europe. And what they talk about in terms of response from the UK presents a pretty poor picture. In non-confiscation cases, I was told by leading countries in the European Union that the response rates that they endure are woeful. One huge country in Europe said that they had spent years making requests for evidence and assistance in cases where they were victims, including murder cases, and got nothing back from the UK. If that were right, that is shameful. And it will do us no favours at all when we go abroad and ask for help. Where, apparently, the UK does very well is in responding to requests for in relation to confiscation. Why? Because when we make the confiscation in support of a foreign confiscation order, when we do their bidding in our country, we get to keep the money. And that, it seems to me, is another example. If this anecdotal evidence is right, another example of a skewed priority. This sort of area of law should not be about making money for the state. It should be about proper deterrence and restorative justice to victims as well. And I hope that the sort of law that we now have from the Supreme Court in the case of Weyer will infect our thinking. Because in the case of Weyer, the Supreme Court has realigned our thinking in relation to proceeds of crime, because it no longer talks about the proceeds of crime law being used to punish people. It talks about it just in terms of ensuring that you remove proceeds of crime, the right amount of proceeds of crime from people. And I think if you take that concept to its logical conclusion, you must also ensure that you don't trample over all the other priorities that you have in the criminal justice system, including those which are about restorative justice for victims and due process for defendants as well. I see the stop sign up. Thank you very much for listening to this.